Welcome to Strong Tower Radio Today. The views and opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect the views of Strong Tower Radio, West Central Michigan Media Ministries, or its employees.
Welcome to Strong Tower Radio's Good Growing with the Garden Guy. This is the December edition, and it will be seasonally flavored. The Garden Guy is Gary Heilig. Welcome, Gary.
Happy to get here. Just came back from a prospecting trip on the shores of Lake Superior.
Oh, maybe we can do a little side trip on that. Hey, Gary is a retired MSU extension agent, and we're so glad to have him on the show. I'm your host, Tom Majeure, and I'm soloing today. Our color commentator, my sister Sue, had a work assignment conflict, and so I'm going it alone on the quiz. I am trembling in my boots right now.
You probably should be.
I won't be able to say, I read that somewhere.
Yeah, well, it's about mangoes.
It's about mangoes. Well, I want you to know that I, even though I knew the topic, I did not do special study because I think that would be cheating. So.
Not necessarily.
So, Gary, why don't you lead us with a word of prayer? Okay.
Our Heavenly Father, we thank you so much for this opportunity to discuss topics of your creation. We pray that the information that people get from this will bring glory to you, and we pray that the program will go well. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
Amen. Well, Gary, I just hope that our ratings don't drop because Sue's not on the show today.
So. Well, we know everybody tunes in because of Sue.
That's right. That's right. Hey, listen, I'm ready.
I'm the straight guy here.
let's talk about mangoes.
All right. Our quiz is about mangoes. You know, mango is a tropical fruit. And when I was doing the research...
Is that the reason why I can't seem to grow it in my garden?
Yeah.
Okay.
especially with the temperatures that we've had lately. Mangoes wouldn't do very well. But it's a tropical plant that we see in the grocery store, and it's become very popular among people here. But I know a lot of people at our church from different countries, and they just say, oh, you poor people, you just don't know what a mango is. And now I know one of the reasons why, which we'll talk about today.
Well, but, you know, let's help our listeners here. I mean, isn't that kind of that oversized egg-shaped green little pinkish, orangish thing that you see?
Well, they'll be green, but they have hints of red and yellow in them. The flesh is similar to a peach, but it doesn't taste anything like a peach.
It has a very sweet flavor.
Yeah, if you get the right ones.
Okay.
They don't always have a sweet flavor. But it has, like I said, the texture similar to a peach, but it's hard to describe it. You can't compare it to anything. It doesn't taste anything like a peach, but it's just delicious. And I love mango nectar.
That's as sweet as it gets.
Yeah, but you don't want to drink a lot of that because that'll put the calories on pretty quickly.
And send your blood sugar high.
Yeah.
Hey,
but go ahead.
Just let's give our listeners, just in case they don't remember it, I said it was egg-shaped. It's kind of green with some different colors of reds and stuff. But it's also, was it like 2 inches in diameter and about 3 or 4 inches long?
No, I think you're going to find a lot of the mangoes. It depends on the cultivar because there are many, many cultivars. But a lot of the ones that we see in, say, Myers or Kroger's, they're usually about 6 inches by about 4 inches. They do have some smaller ones that are about the size that you're talking about. But as I was doing the research for this, some of them have more of a creamy texture. Some are more sweet. Some even have a hint of citrus. And we just don't see those cultivars in our grocery stores. At most, you'll see just a couple. Now, when you get down in the warmer climates where they're not shipped as far, or they may be more well-known in certain areas, like New York may have more cultivars available than what we would see here in Michigan, then there might be a little bit more variety. But when you go to the stores here, I doubt you'll see more than 2 varieties on the shelf.
Well, I hope I'm not preempting one of your quiz questions, but my sister told me that there's possibly more varieties of mangoes than there are varieties of apples.
Well, when I looked at the research on that, it said that there were hundreds They didn't say thousands.
Okay.
So from what I read, it doesn't seem like that's the case because there are over 5,000 named varieties of apples.
Wow.
That's a lot of apples.
Very good. Okay, I'm ready for the quiz, I think.
Here's the first one. Mangoes are the national fruit of three different countries. What are they? And I'll give you a hint.
Oh, thank you.
They're
thank
not you. In cold climates.
Okay, good, good. That's just in the wannabes, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, I thought you were going to give me a hint. Oh, that was the hint, Tom.
Well, would you like another one? I'll give you another hint.
Yes.
Two of the countries start with the letter P.
I like that. How about the Philippines?
That's one of them.
Wow. Where is Paraguay?
South America, but it's not one.
Oh, okay. Oh, boy. Peru.
No, Pakistan.
Pakistan, okay.
And the final one, I would have thought you would have got it based on the cuisine of the food, India.
Well, you know what? My sister told me India was one of them. I forgot that.
Yeah, yes. Because one of the things that I love when I go to an Indian restaurant is mango chutney.
Now, that's a savory food, is it not?
Well, it's kind of sweet, but it also is spicy.
Okay.
And
well, everything is spicy.
Well, yeah. In India, they do eat their food spicy, but there are different spices added than just the ones that we're used to. They will use things that we use, but there's so many other things.
Well, I learned from your pastor, Jermaine Gale, that in East Lansing, they have a lot of restaurants. Do they have a restaurant that serves that particular thing?
We're talking about Indian restaurants, Tom.
Okay.
I've been all over the country
eating
Indian food. We even, one particular time, I was talking to a friend who was from India, and he talked about all the Indian food in Toronto that was really good. So one day, just out of the blue, I said, Jess, you want to go to Toronto for lunch?
Okay.
And she said, sure, why not? And it's a six-hour ride. So we jumped in the car and started driving to Toronto. This was before things were difficult in crossing borders and
stuff. I think you got too much time on your hands.
Yeah. Well, we're real foodies. We should talk about that sometime. Okay. And so on the way up there, we were going to call Canapathy and find out where's the best place to go. He was in Texas. We couldn't get a hold of him.
Oh,
so
no.
We didn't know where the best places to go were. So we drove all the way up there and just kind of picked a place. But yeah, we like Indian food. And in East Lansing, there is saffron.
I've heard of that.
And then there's...
I might have even been there.
Yeah, there's Paradise Biryani Place. There's another one called Persis in Okemos. And then there's another one in East Lansing. I don't remember the name of it right this second. But there were five, but one of them has closed because the owners, whom we knew very well, retired.
Okay.
So, and we didn't get a chance to say goodbye because they retired during the pandemic.
Oh, okay.
They had good Indian food too. So, yeah, it's just wonderful. And you can eat, I'll eat Indian food for breakfast. They open up at like 11:30.
Okay.
All their buffets and things. And you'd eat that one meal and you weren't hungry again until like 6 or 7 at night. That food stays with you.
Very good.
But anyway, here's your next question. The fruits... may have originated from what country in terms of when we look back at history, where they were first described and known to be. Now, I'll give you a hint.
Okay.
It's one of the three countries we talked about.
Okay.
It's really obvious.
Oh, boy. Really obvious?
Yeah.
Oh, boy. What's that? Can I call a lifeline or something like that?
You can call, but I don't know if anybody's going to answer.
Okay. I'm just going to say India.
That's it.
Oh, wow.
I was leading you on there, Tom. You did a good job.
Thank you. I need all help I can get.
But anyway, the mango itself said the English name mango is likely derived from a Tamil word. I don't know if you've ever heard of Tamil tigers out of Sri Lanka.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, and it came from the word manke, or a Karelian word, I guess it's Karelian, and it's called manga, And the Portuguese traders, when they settled in southern India, they're the ones that kind of brought it to Manga, M-A-N-G-A. And then from there, around the 15th or 16th century, it kind of morphed into mango.
Okay.
So
now you know.
You could learn those things from a book like called Etymology. A book on etymology tells you the origin of words. And I think a lot of people out there would say, well, that sounds boring. But actually, many words that we use today have very interesting histories. It's a cool book to get.
I noticed that a lot of words we use, I think, came out of the 15th century. It just seems like that was the Middle Ages or something.
Well, one of the things that I was surprised at was one of the strongest languages that influenced English was French.
Oh, really? Okay.
And so, but there's a lot of French words in English, and right here in Michigan, there's a lot of words that are, like, we went through Marquette last night. That's a French word.
It's kind of the battle between the English and the French throughout
Michigan. That's exactly what it was, Tom. It was a battle for domination over here.
And not only that, depends on if you were on the Mackinac Island or
yeah, yeah. Or and then, of course, we have a lot of Native American
Straits,
words, too.
Right.
Okay, the next one is, what country is the leading producer of mangoes?
Oh, that has to be India.
No, definitely India. And they produce about 18 million tons, mostly for consumption right there in their country.
Well, when I was in India, I stayed for 3 weeks. It was in southern India. It was Madras and Caraway or Carillon or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't go to the store ever, literally, because the produce was all around us. Sometimes it was in the yard, including the bananas and the various fruits. And
well, we had some friends from Jamaica, and mango trees get quite large. And they would say that you could hear the mangoes falling out of the tree at night. And here in America, especially in Michigan, we get a mango. Oh, we just think it's the greatest thing. Down there, they had to clean the stuff up.
Yeah, throw it away.
And, I mean, they could have all the mangoes they wanted. And, of course, when something ripens on the tree, it's far superior to something that's picked for shipping. And to give you an example of what we miss out on, the majority of mangoes that we purchase in the United States are a variety called Tommy Atkins.
Okay.
And the reason why that's the case is this variety grows quickly. It has really nice size and color, resistant to many type of funguses, which is good if you're trying to keep something on the shelf. It doesn't bruise as easily, which means it's quite firm, and it lasts a long time on the supermarket shelf. Now, one of the things we didn't talk about that most people would really like to have is flavor.
Right.
And because of all those characteristics, it's good for exporting and shipping and all the things we mentioned. But it's also tends to be a little bit more stringy and tasteless compared to all the varieties that are out there.
You can't have everything.
No, you can't. I guess, but I've tasted some pretty decent mangoes. As we get mangoes here in the United States. But I think about what could they possibly taste like when they're growing in their native habitat and some of these other varieties that we've never even seen. So how long do you think mangoes have been cultivated?
Well, it seemed like the etymology gave us a hint, so I would say.
A very small hint.
Small hint, okay. Yeah. Well,
remember, it came from India originally.
Well, yeah.
And they're an old civilization. Old. So think of
well,
that.
Well, I mean, really, if you think about it, 1000 BC. How do you like that?
They say about 5,000 years ago. Now, the mangoes growing back then probably aren't the same. I'm sure they weren't, because with hybridization, things have changed. And what they do with hybridization is they try to cross various fruits that have characteristics that we like in order to accentuate those characteristics. So if you're trying to get a sweeter mango, you're going to want to cross two mangoes that are known for their sweetness. So it's been around for quite some time. And it was brought, it says it originated in the foothills of the Himalayas, or the Himalayas, whichever way you want to say that, in India and also in Myanmar. And it was in the Andaman Islands, which is an archipelago of the Bay of Bengal. So if you don't know any of that, get out your maps and start looking around. That's where it came from.
Well, I was pretty proud of myself. I was only 2,000.
That's old for cultivation. 2,000 years old. That's really old. Yeah.
Now, well, I mean, 3,000, I was taking a real risk there.
Now, American apple trees can reach 100 years old. I've seen some that have been 75 to 80 years old, and they'll still produce at that age. How old do you think the longest cultivated mango tree is? Now, it's not thousands.
Okay, good. Thank you for that boundary.
Because there are very few plants that get there. There's a pine, a bristlecone pine, and also the coastal redwoods. They will live for hundreds of years and get in. Some of them, I guess, can get up to 1,000 or so. So how long do you think the oldest living mango tree is that's still producing fruit?
I have no clue, but I'm going to...
I'll give you a hint.
Okay.
It's older than this country.
I was only going to say 150, but I'll have to move it out. I will say 350 years old.
Close. 300 years.
All right.
When you think about that, this tree has been around longer than America has been around. At least, you know, the United States is what we're talking about here.
So who's been watching it all these years?
I don't know, but I wouldn't be surprised if they have it roped off or something so that they can protect it, because there are very few fruit-producing trees that get to that age. There is a pear tree in the east that is, it might be approaching about 200 or so, but they have it in a fence and it's protected because it's such an old tree.
You know, we've talked about India several times here. When I was in India, we went to this arboretum that was set up by the British. And the trees in that arboretum were so old. I can't even remember. It's been been 7, 9 years ago. But everything was huge. Everything was big. Everything was old. And so they've been cultivating for a long time.
Yeah, and the reason why they put fences around a lot of these trees, I remember a news story a few decades ago. Oh, there was a famous oak in Texas somewhere, and somebody decided to kill it. And there was an herbicide called Velpar. They just dumped it around the base of the tree. And they tried to save that tree, but it just kept dying and dying and dying. So you really have to protect things like that, because people, for dumb reasons, will damage it. And I can just imagine, think about when the earth is recreated, and as these trees get to be very old, what they're going to look like. And I didn't think it would be that big a deal until I saw the coastal redwoods and the giant redwoods. Your jaw drops at the scale of those things.
Absolutely.
If you haven't had a chance to see them, you should go, because I remember reading a side saying some people have a religious experience when they see these trees. And I'm rolling my eyes and, come on. I love trees because I'm a horticulturist, but come on.
Yeah.
Religious experience? I saw the trees and I said, oh, my goodness. Yeah. I could not believe it.
Absolutely. Likewise.
Could not believe it. Feel like an ant around them.
Well, Gary, we're going to go into overtime on the quiz. So, listeners, you're listening to Good Growing with the Garden Guy, the December edition. I'm your host, Tom Majeur. We'll be back after this.
Hi, folks. Jelaine Fenner here. We are definitely living in uncertain times, and for some of us, it's scary. Signs of the times are everywhere. Jesus is coming back soon. Read Revelation chapter 22. Jesus says, "Surely I am coming quickly." We at Strong Tower Radio have a free book for you called The Great Controversy. Go to the back of the book and read chapters 35 to 42. It'll help you understand the times we're living in and what's ahead. This book even has 800 historical quotes and 1,200 Bible quotes. I love this book. Call Strong Tower Radio today, 231-468-2087, and ask for The Great Controversy While Supplies Last. And if we don't answer, please leave a message asking for The Great Controversy with your name, address, and phone number. That's 231-468-2087 on Strong Tower Radio, where God's character is proclaimed.
Hello, folks. We're back with Good Growing with the Garden Guy, Gary Heilig, and Tom Majeure, substituting for Sister Sue, who is on assignment with her day job. And we're in the midst of the quiz. We've gone into overtime on the quiz. Gary, what is the next question? We're talking about
mangoes. When do you think mangoes were introduced to the United States?
When were they introduced? They were probably introduced by the Spanish, and that was in the 1700s.
Is that your final answer?
It's the only answer.
Well, they were introduced to the United States by an agricultural explorer named David Fairchild. He worked for the U.S. government, and he brought it here at the turn of the 20th century, so it would have been the late 1900s.
Boy, you got here awfully late.
Yeah, it hasn't been around that long. And he was in India, and he discovered mangoes, and he was going to ship about 1,000 back to the United States. But the boat captain that was going to carry that, he thought the load was too heavy.
Okay.
So what he did is he hired a bunch of local kids to come and eat all the fruit.
Oh.
So that was cold-hearted, I'm telling you.
So, and they shipped all these trees without any mangoes, without any
seeds?
Well,
he was shipping fruit to the country. Oh. And so they ate all this stuff up in just a few minutes, and just leaving the little seeds, the stones. And so what he did is he brought those back instead and then started new trees from them. And there, some of those original trees are still growing in South Florida today.
Hmm.
What do you think is the largest mango according to the Guinness World Book of Records? And so we're going to talk about how much did it weigh and about its length and width.
What we're talking about the fruit.
The fruit, yeah.
Okay. Oh, the longest. I have no reference point.
Well, think about how big the ones we get now.
Okay,
so
you told us.
I wouldn't get crazy.
You said maybe 4 inches in girth and maybe 6 inches long. Of course, they have to be, let's say, 10 inches long and 6 inches wide.
That's a pretty good guess. 12 inches in length, 7 inches in width, and how much do you think that weighed?
Oh, my. 3 pounds.
7.6.
7.6.
Yeah, that's a pretty good-sized mango.
I'd rather buy by the piece than by the pound.
And that was found growing in the Philippines in 2009, so it's a fairly recent record. All right, this one's going to kind of throw you off a bit. What two nuts are related to mangoes?
Two nuts.
And when we say related, we're talking about similar botanically. And so what nuts do you think?
Oh, let's see. All I can think of is Brazil nuts.
You have two choices.
Close. Let's see. Coconuts. Yes, coconuts.
No. Coconuts aren't really a true nut.
Oh.
Cashews and pistachios.
Okay. Good nuts.
So, and a mango, botanically, the fruit is called a drupe, which the drupes that we know of are cherries, peaches. They have that hard inside core, single seed inside. Another example would be...
So you were talking about stone fruit.
Yeah, that's what we would call a stone fruit. That's the fruit is actually called a drupe, Whereas, for instance, an apple is called a pome, and beans are called legumes. And there's a whole bunch of different names for various types of fruits. So anyway, the mango tree is sacred to what religion? Now, think it through, Tom.
Yes, sir.
It has to be a religion that's probably in India.
Yeah, okay. Well, there's Hinduism.
Mm-hmm.
And
what else is in India?
Oh, well, there's three religions there, or four, or maybe even more.
Hinduism. It's also a popular religion in Japan.
Oh, I'm just drawing a blank. I should know as soon as you say I give up.
It's also somewhat popular in China.
I'm not.
And there, and the guy that they look up to is a rather large person.
Buddha. Buddhism. Buddhism. Thank you. Thank you. You're being very kind to me.
Yeah, some of these are really rough. So yeah, the mango tree is sacred to Buddhists. And And one of the reasons I like mangoes too is because they contain over 20 different vitamins and minerals, high in vitamin A, potassium, folate, and they also have quite a bit of fiber. So
are they a super fruit?
Well, based on the fact that it has 20 different vitamins and minerals, I'd have to say yes.
Okay.
And it's certainly delicious. So as long as you don't overdo it, it's pretty much a good guilt-free snack. Certainly beats the daylights out of Doritos.
It does. Is that one of the fruits that help your digestion?
It most likely does. I didn't look that up, but I could say with a lot of confidence, if you eat fruits and vegetables, it's going to help your digestion.
Okay, okay. Well, so, we'll accept that answer.
It's when you eat all that pasty stuff, it's when you have problems. And animal flesh and various other things. We weren't designed for that. And I like to have this discussion. I tell people, you know, there's not going to be steak dinners in heaven. And some people have never thought about that because you have to kill cows in order to do that. Okay, so let's move on to holiday plants.
Okay, what is on your – oh, is that part of the quiz still?
No.
Oh, okay, okay, fresh. So
– you got through that one.
Yes. Holiday plants, let's talk about them. It looks like you've got mistletoe, amaryllis.
Amaryllis.
Amaryllis, poinsettias, Norfolk Island pines, and Christmas cactus. I'm sure there's a few questions there.
Yeah, they are – all these plants have become associated with Christmas. And I thought, let's find out why.
Sure.
And mistletoe is kind of interesting because mistletoe is not politically correct anymore. I mean, the idea was if somebody was caught under the mistletoe, you got a free kiss. I was never a fan of mistletoe because I have a lot of a big personal space, and I just want people coming up kissing on me. Right. I don't even want people to touch me. Yeah. So it was like, no, that I didn't like that at all. But that gets traced all the way back to the Druids.
That's not good.
So it really doesn't have and the other thing was, if somebody was under the mistletoe and they refused to kiss, supposedly they'd get bad luck. Mm-hmm. And I'm just thinking, why do we have mistletoe associated with this holiday? And you see it in movies and it's kind of popular, and people still put mistletoe up in their houses, the plastic stuff, not the real stuff. And by the way, it is mildly toxic. It's not poisonous, but it would give you mild digestive upsets, and if your cat or dog ate it, they wouldn't feel very good, but it wouldn't kill them. And the interesting thing about mistletoe is not what I call a plant with a good reputation. Because it's a parasitic plant. It gets spread by the birds eating the seeds, and then they drop the dung in their dung. And the first part of that word, mistle, actually means dung. That's one of its definitions. So then it grows up a tree, and it's a parasitic tree, so it attaches itself to the tree and starts sucking the nutrients out of it, like a mosquito would take your blood. So still, I said, where's the connection to Christmas here?
Yes, yes.
There really isn't one. But the plant itself was known back, as I said, back during the Druid time. And it was a sacred symbol of fertility and vivacity or something. I guess it's vigorousness. And as I mentioned, it is mildly toxic. So I don't use mistletoe in my house. I don't think it's all that decorative, but that's how I got associated with Christmas. It slowly came along as a kind of a good luck thing, and probably people that just wanted to kiss folks started putting it up in their house. Look, mistletoe.
What about amaryllis?
Now, amaryllis, for those people that don't know what amaryllis is, it's a big bulb that usually comes in a pot, and it has a bloom of maybe three, sometimes four big flowers. They can be pinkish or striped or reddish.
Or even white.
And the reason why that became associated with Christmas was it's bloom time. It blooms right around the Christmas season. And it's been around since Victorian times, and that plant symbolized strength and determination. Again, no real connection to the Christmas story or any of those type of things.
But doesn't it usually have three flowers?
At least three. I think I've seen it with up to four. But it tends to bloom once around the holidays, and you can get it to rebloom, but there's a certain regime that has to rest, and then you start fertilizing it when it starts to grow again. And usually people don't keep them more than 1 year. Most people don't want to spend the time learning how to take care of an amaryllis. But it's strictly because of its blooming time that people start to think of it as a Christmas plant, specifically the red bloom. So they just call it the Christmas amaryllis. It's really a red amaryllis.
Okay.
Then we have the poinsettia, and we've talked a little bit about this in a past program. But this one became associated with Christmas around the 16th century, and it originates in Mexico. And, of course, there's a legend. They don't really know all this for sure, but there was a legend of a little girl, and they said, commonly called Pepita or Maria, which means they didn't know what her name was. Of course, it was a legend, so. And they said that she wanted to give a Christmas gift to celebrate Jesus' birthday, which, by the way, is not December 25th.
Exactly.
We don't know that. And so, but she was too poor to have a gift. So supposedly an angel told her to gather some weeds from the roadside. And if you've ever been down in that area, the poinsettia, especially in southern Texas, grows as a shrub. And as the days get shorter, then it will associate with blooming. It triggers blooming. So most likely in some of those weeds, she probably took some poinsettia tips, and that was part of her gift. Now, poinsettias became an issue, or I shouldn't say an issue, but a thing in America when the first ambassador to Mexico, his name was Joel Roberts Poinsett. He brought them back to the United States from Mexico, and there was some breeding work done with them and all that type of thing. But the people that turned it into a holiday Christmas plant was the Eck family, E-C-K-E. And I think the person's name was Paul. I don't remember that for sure. But anyway, they started promoting it just like... And I'll use this as an analogy. We have a habit in the United States that when somebody gets engaged, a guy gives a girl a diamond. But that is a fairly recent trend. And guys are supposed to really drop some money on diamonds. And
the diamond industry had something to do with that.
They had very much. And the reason they're so expensive is because there's plenty of diamonds around. It's just that they hold back the diamonds to keep the cost artificially high. So But anyway, moving back to the poinsettias, they marketed this and made it a brand, and that's why we had the poinsettias. And I like them. They're red, and they have different colors, and they also paint them now. You can get a white one, and they'll paint them just about any color you want, and they'll put sparkles on them. But it's a nice little plant to decorate the house, and you can take care of it and get it to rebloom if you grow it during the summer. And then around mid-September, you start putting it in the dark around 5 o'clock in the morning, and then before you leave for work at 8 in the morning, uncover it. You could just simply do that by getting a box from Lowe's or Home Depot and covering the plant over at night, and it'll start to bloom. And once you start to see those bracts turn red, then you can stop putting it under the cover, and it'll finish blooming. And it'll start to produce its little flowers, which are those little yellow bumps that you see. So that's how that got started. Then we had the Norfolk Island Pine. And this is called the Norfolk Island Pine because it was endemic to Norfolk Island, which is in the Australian Territory. It's also found in New Zealand coastal areas. And this tree is a, they call it a Norfolk Island Pine, but in order to be a real pine, it has to be in the genus Pinus. And it's not. It's in the genus Araucaria. And it is what's called a carnivorous evergreen. So it's, conifer means cone-bearing.
Okay.
And then evergreen means that it doesn't annually drop its leaves like a maple tree. They, conifers do drop their needles. Like we talked about in the fall, white pine and various others will drop their older needles, like two-year-old needles. But so evergreen doesn't mean that they never drop their needles. But anyway, to make a longer story longer, this tree gets quite large. It gets to be about 200 feet tall, and it became popular because you can grow them inside as a living Christmas tree, but you can't put it outside. So that's how that got associated, and it's very symmetrical, and it's a nice little plant. But if it doesn't have enough light, it will lose all of its lower branches, and it looks ugly.
Okay. Well, let's see if we can get the Christmas cactus in before the break.
Okay. Christmas cactus, there is what we call a Thanksgiving cactus, a Christmas cactus, and an Easter cactus. And the leaves look a little different for each one, but the reason why they call it the Christmas cactus is it's similar to the poinsettia, that as the days get shorter, it will trigger the bloom and will bloom right around Christmas. They're quite nice, and a lot of times, senior citizens that live alone and they go to bed at a certain time and they have a Christmas cactus in the house, they'll always bloom. And the younger people will say, I can never get mine to bloom. Well, they're coming in the room where it is and turning lights on all hours of the day and night, and it just messes up its blooming sequence. So a lot of times you see the older ladies, they'll have them, they'll do really well because they subject it to the conditions. So anyway, they think this came from South America somewhere, but they're not really sure where it originated from.
Well, very good. Well, looks like we got through the quiz, or we got to about the Christmas plants. After this, we're going to talk about Christmas trees. So, listeners, stay tuned. You're listening to Good Growing with the Garden Guy, Gary Heilig, and your host, Tom Majeure. We'll be back after this.
The Bible and God's character are under attack like never before. Here at Strong Tower Radio, we are proud to hold up the Bible as a lamp unto our feet and a light unto our path. We believe the Bible is the Word of God and contains the good news of God's character and His great plan of salvation for mankind. If you know and believe this to be true, won't you help Strong Tower Radio proclaim the truth about our God and His Word, the Bible? To do that, go to www.strongtowerradio.org, and there, on our secure website, you will find a donate button. Click on that and give as the Lord directs. Thank you for listening and supporting Strong Tower Radio, where God's character is proclaimed.
We're back with Good Growing with the Garden Guy, Gary Heilig, the Garden Guy. He's a retired MSU, Michigan State University. That's not Mississippi State University. It's Michigan State University. One time I was driving to Mississippi. It might have been the first time, and we were on US 41, and over every overpass there was MSU. I said, there must be Michigan State fans down here. Apparently it was a local culture.
I wonder if there's a Montana State University.
Oh, I'm sure there is.
Some of these others, yeah.
Absolutely. So an acronym, you don't own it, I guess.
No.
Hey, listen, we have yet to talk about Christmas trees, and being here at Strong Tower Radio, I've been here, the station moved here, I think, about 5-6 years ago, and across the street is a Christmas tree farm.
Yeah, I was watching those grow since they planted them.
And this is, they've already harvested, they harvest them a few years back, and we're watching that whole cycle again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you were growing something like a Scotch pine, which has kind of fallen out of favor as being the top Christmas tree because of the trunks that aren't always straight, and depending on what cultivar you grow, the needles will turn yellow when it gets cold. The favorite now are the firs, like Fraser fir. But they take longer. You can get a Scotch pine off in about 7 years under the best conditions, but when you start talking about firs, you're talking about 9, 10, 11, 12 years, depending on what cultivar or fir, because there's Canaan, there's Balsam, there's Nordman fir, Concolor fir. There's quite a few different firs, and they're much nicer trees, easier to handle because the needles are very soft. But I thought about, people might ask, well, what does it take to grow a Christmas tree?
Well, I'll tell you, living across the street from it, it takes a lot. It's amazing as the Christmas tree farm is there and the workers come here. It's the Dutchman farm out of the Manton area up here. And I'm surprised how many times they come and work this field they have to deal with. First, of course, they have to cultivate it. They have to plant it. From time to time, they do something to break down the weeds. And so the trees have a better chance and grow. They don't have to compete with anything. And then there's fertilizing, and there's, I don't know if they do watering. There is water.
Usually
over
there. No. Okay. They don't have to water trees. But if you wanted to grow some on your own, you'd go to some of the nurseries and you can order the trees. A lot of the commercial nurseries will require you to buy at least 50 trees. They do have a situation where you can buy as few as 10. So it depends on the company. But when you plant them, one of the things a person could do in a home situation is put down a landscape fabric right after you plant them. And that pretty much eliminates your weed problems. And the first 3 or 4 years, you don't have to do a whole lot except keep the weeds under control. In a small situation, if you get into a droughty situation, especially on a light sandy soil, give them some supplemental watering. Fertilizing, there are tablets that you can buy that you can put in the ground when you plant the trees, but fertilizing would not be a problem for most people either. You just go by with a cup and you put a certain amount on each tree, very quickly done early in the spring before growth starts. Now, the real work, if somebody was trying to grow a Christmas tree at home, is the shearing. In order to get those nicely symmetrical trees, they have these shearing knives. They look sort of like a thin machete. And when the new growth is soft, which is usually around June, you take this machete and you put it at a certain angle. And it takes some practice to do that. And what I would suggest, if you really want to do this, is go watch somebody do this first. And they probably won't mind as long as you stay back. And what they would do is they put the hand that they weren't using on their belt so that it was nowhere near this machete because they're very sharp. And then they would just slice right down at the angle that they wanted, and they just walk around the tree.
And slicing downward at an angle?
Yeah, slicing downward from the top. And it takes a little practice to get the right angle. And there are different angles. Some people want wider trees. Some want more narrow trees. So you'd have to learn how to do that. And Also, you want to be sure that your leader doesn't die out. If it dies out when it's really young, you'd have to establish a new one. Which,
and the leader is the point of
the top. The top, because everything That's, comes from that leader. And if the leader dies, you're not going to have a good tree, because then you have multiple leaders coming up. So you can correct that if you catch it early enough. And then they need to be sheared annually. And after the number of years for the type of tree you're going to grow, it works. You'll have a Christmas tree. Now, it may not be as perfect unless you're pretty good at learning how to shear, but some people may not want to shear that much. They want a more open tree, because when you shear it, it's a more solid tree because it tends to branch out more. And I've seen some trees that were sheared so tightly that you couldn't hang ornaments on the inside of the tree. You wouldn't be able to see them. You could only hang them on the outside, which isn't the way to go.
That's frustrating.
Yeah. But and what you would do if you wanted to have a constant supply of them, you'd have to plant about
stagger them
10 a year. And of course, they're going to be ready and you only need one. So you could sell the rest of them if you wanted.
Or you may get a lot of friends.
Yeah, or you can give them as gifts. It's not that difficult to grow a Christmas tree. Time is the big deal. Now, I'll hit my 70th birthday in December, and so if I was growing firs, I wouldn't get my first harvest until around 80. It wouldn't necessarily stop me from doing it just for the fun of it, but I might not ever see the harvest. So you have to think about that.
That's right. So, you know, you can grow them, but some people, part of the experience is the U-cut. You go out and cut your own tree.
One of the traditions we had with our family is I would always go to a different U-cut farm every year because I wanted to find out what was going on in the Christmas tree industry, and I would look for certain species, and my top species is Grand Fir, but you can only find them on the western part of the state. And they're hard to find. It's just a beautiful fir, and the needles are a little bit longer than Fraser, and it's an open tree. And if you break the little pustules along the trunk, it smells like tangerines. It's just a really cool tree. But we'd make a big deal out of it. We'd take the kids out for breakfast, and then we'd go someplace. It was an all-day thing. And if back in the days when they used to make really nice Christmas movies, nowadays, Christmas movies are just terrible. But we would take the kids to a Christmas movie, and then we'd have a special time where we would bring the tree in and start the decoration process. We made a whole day of it, and the kids really enjoy doing that. So you can make your traditions of doing those types of things if you put up Christmas trees. Not everybody does that for Christmas.
Well, you know, we did it once or twice growing up, and then we did it with my wife's family. And so there's interesting memory, wonderful memories. But I had the hardest part for me was choosing the right tree.
Well, if the whole family's there, it's a negotiation. Because the guys in our family, my son and I, wanted the biggest tree we can get in the house. My wife was saying, let's get a smaller tree this year. And we just say, no, it's got to go to the ceiling. So, and we bought somewhere, if we didn't cut it back, the tree would have gone up, curved, and went to the sideways. But, yeah, and then, of course, you have to decide on what species you want. We all settled on firs because we had a blue spruce once, and blue spruce have very firm needles. And decorating that thing was punishment.
Yes.
And we said, never again. It was a beautiful tree because they had that blue hue because of the waxy coating on the needles. But it just wasn't very much fun.
Wow. Yes. And have you ever had trouble getting it through the door?
No, because a lot of times when you go to Christmas tree places, they have what they call shakers that will shake all the extra needles out, and then they have balers, which will wrap a baling wire, not wire, but twine around the tree. And what we would do is just bring it in with that still on it, and then we would put it in the stand, which made it easier to put it in the stand while it was still bound. And then all you had to do is snip it once, and the tree goes boom, it would come out.
instant tree.
Yeah, it was nice, but it's much easier when they're bound like that to bring it in the house, and you don't get as much mess around.
Absolutely. Also, sometimes putting something on the floor to catch some of the needles and so on and so forth.
Yeah, but when you have a tree that's been shaken and then they have the binding around it and you keep that on, you hardly have any needles drop compared to if you're trying to get a tree that won't fit through the door through. You get a whole trail of needles that fall out. And then, of course, going to the U-cut places, a lot of times they'll have other things you can buy, like decorations, wreaths. They'll have rides, like horse rides or what they call the hay ride, and they move the tree up there for you. And there's just a lot of stuff that makes it easy, and the kids really enjoy it. They'll have hot chocolate and things that you can buy, like donuts. And
so does that qualify for your point of advantages of cutting your own trees?
Well, I always tell people, my son was one of these, well, we want to get an artificial tree you think is terrible that you're cutting all these trees down. I said, wait a minute, those trees would have never been planted if it wasn't for the Christmas tree industry. And they're there for like 10 years. And during that time, it's wildlife sanctuary. They're taking carbon out of the air. They're releasing oxygen. They're cover for various animals like rabbits trying to get away from, say, a hawk or something like that. There's so many advantages. They keep erosion down. Trees will collect dust from the air. And so there's a lot of advantages to that. Whereas when you buy an artificial tree, it's an oil product. And there's you can't recycle those trees, so they can go into the landfill. With a natural tree, you can put it out in the yard and it can still be cover, like in a snowbank for the trees during a snowstorm. You can cut off the branches and use the main trunk to train, say, beans up in your garden. Or you can have it chipped up. A lot of places will chip it up, and then they have mulch available for people to use in their gardens. So, no, it's far superior to artificial trees. Now, if somebody has allergies, like my sister-in-law, then, you know, you don't want to have it. But there are a lot of advantages if you're going to have a Christmas tree.
We actually, I have a fake one, but artificial, but I go out and get a live one, and I put it next to my bird feeder far enough away that the squirrels can't jump from the tree to the bird feeder, and that provides shelter because it's a wide open area, and some of the birds of prey sometimes pick off some of the
birds. They will pick off the songbirds, and that cover will protect them somewhat.
Yeah.
And the other thing is that you think about, if you look at where most of these Christmas trees are coming from, many of them came from China. And when you grow the trees here, that's American jobs. The money stays here. And there's just so many advantages if you think it through. Yeah. But I'm not down on people that want artificial trees, because there's some really nice looking artificial trees and they're less messy and you can just pack it away and use it the next year. So there are advantages too. But I've always liked trees, being a horticulturist, and the idea of bringing a tree into the house even for a couple of weeks is a great idea for me. Well, so I would like to do it just for the fun of it.
Also, going back to the growing of the trees, they're growing on ground that you probably wouldn't be growing many vegetables. There's some.
Yeah, they can be grown on marginal ground where other things wouldn't grow so well.
Very good. Well, in the last couple minutes, let's talk about Christmas gifts for the gardeners.
Well, I think about this because there are many things that you can get gardeners. One of the worst things for me to get for Christmas was clothing. I thought that was the most boring thing. But as a gardener, if you gave me, say, a soil thermometer or a moisture meter or a gift certificate to my favorite seed catalog or garden center, or a gift subscription to a gardening magazine. There are lots of cool gardening magazines that deal with just about everything from growing fruit to landscaping, ideas for things that you can do on your deck or patio, buying indoor plants. You have to protect them. And there are companies that have very exotic begonias and things that you just don't find at the garden center. And Christmas ornaments with plant themes, or heated gloves for working outside.
Ooh, I like that.
They are really nice. They're not necessarily cheap.
That's why they should be gifts, right?
Yeah. Quality pruning tools. Maybe somebody would like to grow some of their own mushrooms. You can get various types of mushroom kits, like the button mushrooms, oyster mushrooms, shiitake mushrooms, and you can grow them in your own house. A nice gardening hat, or sunglasses, or maybe an assortment of things like or an organic bug spray, your material that you're going to use for sunscreen. You can make up a little gardening pack, a balm for your hands, and so you can make up your own little gift pack, or skincare products. You can put them in there too. So you can just go on Amazon for ideas, or you can Google what are some great ideas for gifts for gardeners. I just gave you some examples, but there are many, many things that gardeners will be really happy about. And, you know, Dad opening another pair of socks for Christmas, let's do something different.
Well, Gary, you really touched on it. My sister, who is the co-host on this mm-hmm. program, she has given me some of the most delightful Christmas gardening tips. She's got me a harvesting apron. Mm-hmm. So that when you're harvesting your apples or even harvesting tomatoes in your garden, you don't have to go back to that box quite so often. You just like they do for trees, you just open it up and out gently mm-hmm. spill the produce out. One was she bought a root slayer. Have you ever heard of that?
No, I haven't, but I can guess what it probably is.
It's modeled after a Japanese tool. It's a very strong utility digging tool, and it helps you get those roots out. I've used it so many of these things. And Sue, the heated gloves is number one on my list this year.
But you mentioned tools. There's lots of cool gardening tools. If people have problems with carpal tunnel or something, there are ergonomic tools. And another thing you can do if you're looking for ideas, you can go to some of the more popular garden channels, and many times they will have things. We used to call them trinkets and trash in the Master Gardener program, but what they are is people will sell various things like T-shirts or hats or aprons, or and they'll have either garden sayings on them or beautiful pictures or whatever. So there are people out there have little side hustles that will come up with ideas, or Etsy will have things on there that maybe you didn't think about. And when you put a little thought into it, and they're not expecting that, that's really neat.
Absolutely. My brother-in-law, I really appreciated this. He had a personalized hat made for me. Mm-hmm. It was the Majeure Farm. So that's for your gift list for your gardening friends and family. Well, this has been Good Growing for the Garden Guy. This has been the December issue. And until next time, I'm your host, Tom Majeure, for the Strong Tower Radio Network. Bye now.